My name is Derek Yach. I'm the president of a foundation for a smoke-free world. And it's a pleasure to welcome Sud Patwardhan to the latest in the series on Global Health Perspectives podcasts. We've been holding these starting during the start of the COVID-19 pandemic and really talk about issues related to smoking, global health, and where it made sense, the pandemic, with a range of people around the world. Sud is somebody who has straddled both the world of Indian medicine, US in terms of training, and lives now in the UK. And I think has a career that is both fascinating and important to be able to take on the challenges of transforming the tobacco sector. So it'd be good just to talk through your background in where you did medicine and how you moved to California at the time and the height of the Human Genome Project.
First of all, thank you so much for inviting me on your podcast, Derek. I feel extremely honored. And let's to answer your question about my journey from India to the US via Singapore to the UK, I guess. It starts in Pune, where at BJ Medical College, I did my medical training, and I got attracted to making sense of big data to solve big public health problems. This was, as you said, the peak of the Human Genome Project work, and I wanted to be part of this new healthcare revolution, from better understanding diseases to realizing personalized medicine. So after finishing my medical degree, I picked up programming skills and did computational biology research at top places in California, such as the Keck Graduate Institute in Claremont, the Global R&D Center of Pfizer in La Jolla, and then moved to Eli Lilly's Systems Biology Division in Singapore. So that was quite an interesting journey already for someone trained as a medical doctor in India to do research in the US in a very new and upcoming field, very much anchored and rooted in public health and medicine, really.
Yeah, that makes it even more interesting to think about the next move, having been anchored in clinical laboratory and the scientific aspects at the start of, say, the Human Genome Project and what has become the explosion of innovation. Tell us about your next move to British American Tobacco and what actually persuaded you that you could continue to advance health by joining them.
So around that time, around 2005, having worked in a bit of academia, more of the pharmaceutical industry, I quickly realized that I wanted bigger challenges in public health, where I could bring together my medical training, my understanding of science, and also strategic thinking skills. So in 2005, when the opportunity in tobacco harm reduction research, a mouthful term, mind you, for that time, and perhaps even now, when that opportunity came up with British American Tobacco, it was the perfect place to do groundbreaking work that could solve one of the largest persistent public health problems using science tools. Of course, as you can imagine, I considered what it would mean for a doctor to work in a tobacco company, but I was confident that I could make a difference from within a legal but controversial industry. And I could see an opportunity that I could use the large resources and technical know-how I thought they had, and they indeed did, was available within these large organizations to make a real difference to the millions of consumers of their products that were being killed prematurely by using those products. Of course, if I may just finish with one thing, when I was offered the job, I put one condition to join the company. I said, look, all the research that I do or I lead should be made public and open for scrutiny by external experts. They agreed, and that's been the story of all the work that I did and my teams did following that, leading to a significant increase in the publications in the company after I started and then ever since. So that's the kind of story to how I got there.
Of course, you got there at a time when in 2012, BAT was starting to look at the acquisition of an e-cigarette company, which I'm sure was a very strange thing for a tobacco company to do. Remember, this is 8 years ago. Just talk about that process and how there was support or not support within the company to go down what at the time was a, I'm sure, regarded as a very contentious path.
So by 2012, my work in the company had led to a good understanding of the challenges with creating or getting a product which has true reduced risk potential. So one of the big learnings based on the science framework we had put together in our research teams was that a safer form of combusted tobacco is not possible using 21st century technology. And this was a big learning, mind you. Also, a big learning was that to help science-driven regulators understand the issues with regulating future safer products, we need to be able to do a lot of science and be able to present them with the data. But that's going to be one of the biggest challenges. So with these things in mind, the opportunity in 2012 was something worth not missing, and that was to acquire a company that was in the emerging e-cigarette space, but were also aspiring to get license from the UK Medicines Agency. And so I was very keen to advocate such an approach, which allows us to have the right level of safety and quality standards in place, the right kind of marketing standards in place to ensure that these products are clearly targeted for current adult tobacco users. And so all these things came together, and the company made the right choice in acquiring what was then the largest and the first big tobacco acquisition of an e-cigarette company. And I'm very proud that I was involved and associated with that process of identifying the company, also making the recommendation for why we need to do that.
And yeah, and you mentioned the importance of having standards. And of course, the British Standards Institution did actually create what I believe is the world's first and only comprehensive standards on e-cigarettes. Is that correct? And love to know your role in actually getting that moving.
So as the e-cigarette category started evolving rapidly in the UK, there was definitely a lot of movement around the sort of regulatory space around this category. And it was at that time not captured by existing regulations. So a very clear drive was to create standards for quality, safety, manufacturing, and so on. And the right place to go and do this was the British Standards Institution, or BSI, very respected, reputable, and globally renowned for putting some very strong, solid processes to come to the standards and then police and enforce them. So when I was involved in the setting up the team that was involved in putting the standards in place, the bigger challenge was to bring a whole range of stakeholders to the table. And that was a big learning, but also a big success for that team. So let's just understand that, and let's be very clear, the technical know-how on product stewardship, safety, quality standards is not rocket science, but it does need a collaborative approach between academia, industry, and national regulatory and trading standards agencies. And that's what we achieved in the process, which is why when we published the BSI specification, to be precise, that is now effectively been incorporated as part of the UK standards when they assess any product that is aspiring to get medical licensing for e-cigarettes. Just to make the point that these are now included as part of the broader regulatory kind of package that's required by companies submitting an approval for medically licensed e-cigarettes.
Yeah, and of course that then jumps into where you are today, actually encouraging and supporting the use of those products in the clinical setting as a means of both cessation and reducing the risk. From your experience, do you think that there are other countries likely to follow the UK route, both in terms of setting the standards and then supporting their use in the clinical setting?
So 2 years ago, I left the tobacco industry to co-found the Center for Health Research and Education, or CHRE. CHRE is an independent healthcare company dedicated to global cancer prevention. So enabling and delivering tobacco cessation is top on our agenda. The challenge that, and which is perhaps why when I mentioned this is the world's, these were the world's first and only truly comprehensive standards even today, is because the appetite and the understanding and the technical know-how to do this around the world is quite limited. And it's an issue of local capacity, especially in the low and middle income countries. So again, this kind of makes me really worried and concerned, but also I'm very keen to see that there is capacity building in tobacco product science, because that is crucial for making the world free from risky tobacco. Unless countries and local researchers and academia and even industries are fluent in understanding tobacco product science as it exists today, they will not be able to put in regulatory frameworks for assessing future safer alternatives and cessation products. And so for them to be able to appropriately assess, regulate, and allow these next generation products, which have a potential to replace risky tobacco, getting the product science capacity in these countries is absolutely crucial.
Yeah, that's something you've certainly been giving a lot of guidance both to us and to folk, particularly in India, about doing and getting on with, given the huge potential life-saving effect. Just to comment on one of the tobacco harm reduction categories, we know that smokeless tobacco products in India are usually of the lethal kind that explain the very high levels of oral cancer. Yet there are a lot of innovations in the nicotine pouch and related areas that could potentially displace this and give people their nicotine without the cancers. Do you think this is something that is likely to happen? Can it happen? What will it take to actually reduce and end the use of the toxic products?
So this has got so many layers to the question, Derek. Where do we start? But let's start with what the current products are in India. As you know, the risk profile of the products is very high, given what is put in the products, but also how the tobacco is processed. So it takes us back into to fundamental issues of product manufacturing.
This is the risk, just for people, this is the risk profile of the current smokeless portfolio on the Indian market.
That's right. And there is some science done to that. I know there are other projects that the foundation has supported to really be able to get enough data on existing products in the market. What is very evident from all the science we have reviewed over the years now is that there are no existing manufacturing standards at all, which means that companies can put whatever they want. There is nobody policing the marketplace to see what has gone into it and what does it mean in terms of actual impact to the user. What is only evident, and I've seen this as a medical doctor in training, oral cancers are rampant in India. India is the oral cancer capital of the world, unfortunately. And the use of oral tobacco among 200 million users in India is the primary driver for that. So we know that the products have a nasty chemical mix in them. We know that they do cause a lot of harm. To answer your other question, is there a potential among products such as nicotine pouches or other safer nicotine replacement products to be able to change this kind of disease pattern arising out of risky tobacco in India? For sure, yes. I think there are products which can deliver nicotine, in this case, pharmaceutical standards nicotine in a pouch as it's currently manufactured in countries such as the UK and in Sweden. And it is not tobacco. It is pure nicotine given with flavorings enough to make it attractive for the tobacco users to want to replace with. So there is potential. I would like to flag at this point that, again, this is almost reminding me as a sense of strange sense of deja vu that 10 years ago, 12 years ago, when the e-cigarette category was evolving rapidly, it of course had the tobacco harm reduction potential written all over it. But it also created a lot of concerns among those in public health, and rightly so, of how these products will be used potentially by those who are not current tobacco users. What about youth who will start these products? And I wish enough was done by people, the entire stakeholder community, and I include industry, public health, even consumers and advocates and champions, to ensure that some of these concerns were addressed right then and enough standards put in place right then to prevent what we see today, which is a very, very divided world. On one hand, we have consumers championing the e-cigarettes I'm talking about now because they've experienced it as a harm reduction tool for them. On the other, there are those in public health who are genuinely concerned that this is going to be leading to a new epidemic of new tobacco products, new nicotine products use. The same may potentially happen with nicotine pouches unless companies who are currently marketing them don't take a proactive step in clarifying that these are for current tobacco users, that these are made to high standards. These are the standards. Here is the report on the manufacturing, the quality and the chemistry data, and really be proactive about it. That's the only way I see for maximizing the potential of this great category.
We've seen recently that the Australian government is looking at considering e-cigarettes to be made available on prescription from doctors. Now, I imagine that the upside of that is that it means that there would be the oversight on quality and the direct links. Of course, the downside is that that's going to probably exclude a huge amount of the market. And we've seen things evolve to over-the-counter in many countries, maintaining the standards. But it does raise that under any scenario, the role of the doctor seems to be paramount. And yet your own survey in India recently showed what a high proportion of doctors seem to have extremely little knowledge about the true impact of nicotine or the value of harm reduction. How does one overcome that? And what was actually the key findings of that study?
Maybe I can take a step back, Derek, if you don't mind. If I look at around the early 2010, 2011 time, I was looking at how cigarettes, tobacco, nicotine, and smoking were interchangeably used in the lay media. And when I thought about it, even my medical education had not bothered to do a clear distinction between these. It was all lumped together. So as we start thinking of solving the world's problem with risky tobacco use, it's getting clearer to me that the most fundamental roadblock is the misunderstanding of nicotine. Of course, nicotine is the addictive component of tobacco. Yes, a non-tobacco user is better off not starting nicotine use in any form and so on. However, if we can provide safer nicotine to the billion plus risky tobacco users globally to manage their cravings and to prevent their very highly likely relapses, there is an obvious great public health dividend at the other end. Now, to answer your question about how do we address the nicotine myths or the misperceptions about nicotine among the population generally, but also specifically among healthcare practitioners, it is not insurmountable. It's more of a job of assuring ourselves that the kind of curricula that doctors are currently having in their education. So medical curricula in India, for example, nicotine was not mentioned at all, except for saying, yes, it's part of tobacco and it's all very harmful. So addressing curricular changes is a good starting point. Practicing physicians, as we have seen from our survey in India, currently nearly 80% of those we surveyed at least thought nicotine in tobacco causes cancer, which is not true. So busting some of these myths with science-based, evidence-based materials will be a good starting point. Continuing medical education, where most doctors are now required to be part of that, that's the place to reach out to them with very fact-based, evidence-based engagement. And that could be a start of a change in their thinking about nicotine and then their practice about nicotine.
Yeah, thanks, Sid. I just want people listening to maybe take a look at a website we just launched exactly in line with Sud's thinking, www.understandingnicotine.org. And you can get a hint of what's going to come. It's deliberately aimed at recognizing nicotine sits centrally in the question around safe and unsafe forms of tobacco use. And the more insights we have about public perception, the direction of the science, and who is filing patents for future products and innovations, the more we will have an assurance of whether this is a way forward where we can actually reduce smoking. Let me end with one last issue, Sud. You guest editor of the Drugs and Alcohol Policy Special Edition on 15 years after the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. It'd be good just to know, what do you see as the high points of this, and what are your plans to release this and popularize some of the key findings?
So you're talking about the special issue in the Drugs and Alcohol Today journal that was recently published. And the one thing we realized while putting it together, and you were very much involved in it as an author, but also from the strategic guidance point of view, which I was very, very, very fortunate about. One thing that really struck out for me was the lack of inclusion of diversity, development and broader tobacco harm reduction concepts in the way current tobacco control world acts and things. So a question that really got me thinking was, how often do we see these issues addressed as key issues in any global public health conference related to tobacco control? Rare, if at all. So,
yeah.
And having closely analyzed the published reports from the past 5 Conference of Parties over the last 10 years of the FCTC, I came to 3 conclusions. The consumer is left out and stigmatized. Second is, low and middle income countries are in a mad race to copy-paste policies written in the ivory towers of London, New York, or Geneva, with no suitable infrastructure or expertise to actually implement them and reap its true benefits. And the third biggest thing I thought in the current kind of tobacco control landscape was that not all stakeholders were invited. And we thought, this is not right. The problem is of a global nature, and every stakeholder has a role to play, including being accountable for their actions and being held accountable for what they do or what they do not do. So what we have decided to do is take the findings from the various papers published in this special issue. It's been publicized a lot through social media, and people have come back with a lot of constructive comments, appreciation of us putting a spotlight on things that were previously not even talked about. For example, smoking and mental health. The gender bias in tobacco control is often just forgotten. The very fact that although 80% of the world's risky tobacco users live in low and middle income countries, if you look at the published research on tobacco control, it's skewed more towards the Western world, where the problem is over the years of tobacco control now, the problem is manageable, reduced at least. But we have such gaps in research and capacity in the developing world. So with that in mind, we said, look, we need to talk about this in a forum where everyone's invited. And that led to the birth of this 15 years conference. Now, of course, you were the one of the architects of the FCTC, so I shouldn't be telling you this. But 15 years ago, the FCTC came into force. And I think it's a great time to reassess, to evaluate the great successes the FCTC has achieved in terms of policies being rolled out globally, but also some of the stumbling blocks in its implementation, especially in LMICs where capacity or infrastructure may not exist. And I think the opportunity with this conference, so today we're talking about this, and tomorrow and the day after, the 30th of September and the 1st of October 2020, this conference will be held virtual online in two panels. The first panel is where the topics of diversity and development will be discussed with a very special bunch of experts from around the world. And the second day, the panel will discuss tobacco harm reduction policy and practice, again with a very distinguished expert panel discussing these topics. But it's not just for the panelists to talk about. The idea of this conference is to be open, inclusive, free to register, but also for people to use the opportunity to put questions, to challenge us, but also challenge each other. And as I said at the beginning, to hold companies accountable, to hold public health accountable for what they are doing, what they should be doing, and not just in the developed world. I think it's crucial to also remind ourselves that still in the Bangladeshes and the Indias and the Indonesias, risky tobacco products are being sold with very less control by tobacco control and very poor policing of that. Companies that sell these products also have global presence. So they have to also ensure that they can't be promoting reduced risk products in one part of the world, but not making available the same products, but also ensuring that they actually walk the talk they do globally.
Yeah, thanks, Sudhan. I hope everybody is able to sign into that because I think the fact that the best way to answer the question, what's the success of the Framework Convention, which I do believe has had a lot of process-related progress, though, is to look at the numbers. 1.3 billion users of tobacco in the world, 7 million dying directly from the use of tobacco, and another million dying because of the impact of secondhand related products suggests that we have a long way to go. And I hope this will help drive that process. Let me thank Sud enormously, and both for his leadership in the field, as well as for taking part. And let me remind people that you can contact us at podcast@smokefreeworld.org. And we hope to come back to you soon with the next version. In the meantime, we're still in the midst of a pandemic. Stay safe, wear your masks, socially distance, get your flu vaccine. And thank you very much again, Sud.